From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When you're a child, do you believe everything your father tells you?
He was looking for gold. And when he got that gold, he was going to build us a big glass house in the middle of the desert that would be heated entirely through solar energy, and all the appliances and everything would run off the solar energy. And that, of course, was the glass castle.
A famous New York gossip columnist looks back on the hardscrabble childhood she worked hard to forget later this hour. Today, American Stories. We'll get behind the stoic faces of the classic painting American Gothic. Meet the alt-country band Freakwater, who are putting a new spin on tradition. And find out what apples are best to create that timeless American metaphor, the apple pie.
The grocery store apples I don't like. Grocery store apples have all the fiber of a politician's moral courage and all the flavor of a CEO's reading habits. Those are the apples you don't want to use.
In some ways, America is based on a story. The idea that anyone, no matter how poor and downtrodden, can rise again, pull themselves up from the bottom to live a life of comfort and plenty. Well, Jeanette Walls lived one version of the American dream. Today, Walls is a famous gossip columnist in New York on MSNBC. But her childhood was anything but glamorous. Walls grew up with nomadic parents who were often fleeing creditors and living in cars, abandoned buildings, and shacks. Walls' memoir about her childhood is called The Glass Castle. Here she is reading an excerpt.
I was sitting in a taxi, wondering if I had overdressed for the evening, when I looked out the window and saw Mom rooting through a dumpster. It was just after dark. A blustery March wind whipped the steam coming out of the manholes, and people hurried along the sidewalks with their collars turned up. I was stuck in traffic 2 blocks from the party where I was heading. Mom stood 15 feet away. She had rags tied around her shoulders to keep out the spring chill and was picking through the trash while her dog, a black and white terrier mix, played at her feet. Mom's gestures were all familiar. The way she tilted her head and thrust out her lower lip when studying items of potential value that she'd hoisted out of the dumpster. The way her eyes widened with childish glee when she found something she liked. Her long hair was streaked with gray, tangled and matted, and her eyes had sunk deep in their sockets. But still, she reminded me of the mom she'd been when I was a kid, swan diving off cliffs and painting in the desert and reading Shakespeare aloud. Her cheekbones were still high and strong, but the skin was parched and ruddy from all those winters and summers exposed to the elements. To the people walking by, she probably looked like any of the thousands of homeless people in New York City. It had been months since I laid eyes on Mom, and when she looked up, I was overcome with panic that she'd see me and call out my name, and that someone on the way to the same party would spot us together, and Mom would introduce herself, and my secret would be out. I slid down in the seat and asked the driver to turn around and take me home to Park Avenue.
Jeanette Walls reading from her memoir, The Glass Castle. She told Steve Paulson that her current life in New York is a surprising one, considering her background.
There's a certain irony to the fact that all of these years I've been digging out the truth about other people and was hiding the truth about myself. I sometimes wonder whether or not there was some sort of, that was somehow what motivated me. But no, it's not at all what people expected. It was a secret for me, my past, and it's something that I hid. And there was no doubt in my mind that if the truth got out about me, that I would lose my job and that I would lose all of my friends and that people would basically run for the exits when I came into a room. But I've never been so wrong about anything in my life.
Hmm. You were worried that people would find out that you had been really, really poor.
Not just poor. We looked up at poor people when I was growing up. There were things that were very difficult for me to write because I'd never told anybody about these things. You know, that I went in the garbage cans at school to fish for other kids' lunches and, you know, went into the stalls in the ladies' room to eat the sandwiches that other people had thrown away. I was ashamed. I was just ashamed of who and what I was and my past. You know, I underestimated people's capacity for compassion. But I think, moreover, I think I underestimated the degree to which everybody has something in their past that they think makes them somehow less of a person. Maybe not quite as extreme as mine, but something.
Hmm. Were your parents just not able to hold down regular jobs, or did they just not want to?
My parents are both highly intelligent people. Well, my father is since died, but they're both very intelligent. My mother has a couple of college degrees, but they both wanted their freedom. They abhorred rules and structure, and they just live life by their own rules.
What kinds of places did you live in?
For the first 10 years of my life, I lived in more towns than I could count. We lived in little mining towns in the Southwest, or we lived in little gambling towns, or sometimes we slept in the car, sometimes we slept in cardboard boxes. Sometimes we went to places like Las Vegas and lived in hotels, or San Francisco and slept on the beach. We just lived wherever Dad decided to move us at the moment. He called it doing the skedaddle. We were always running away from people. Dad said it was the CIA or the mafia, but Mom said it was really just the bill collectors. Hmm.
So you became a really good student, a model student.
First of all, I loved school because it was really warm and dry. But also, you know, to my parents' credit, for everything that was wrong with them, they instilled in us from a very early age a love of reading and education. And I loved school and I loved the teachers. And for the most part, the teachers were very, very good to me. In fact, I was named after a teacher. She had been my father's teacher. And she was the first person who told him that he might actually amount to something someday. And then when we went back to West Virginia, she was still teaching. And I became the editor of the school newspaper, and some people tried to get me kicked off because I dressed so shabby and smelled pretty funky. And she went to bat for me. So I loved the teachers for a lot of reasons.
Hmm. Were you a pariah in school?
Oh, I was worse than a pariah. I had no friends at all. But it was through the newspaper, finding out that I could write about people, that I could actually go to the dances and go to the ball games for the first time. And it was my entree into becoming not a big somebody, but just somebody at all. And I fell completely in love with journalism, and I saw very quickly that it was not only my way to be accepted by my peers, but my way out.
So this was the makings of a gossip columnist
then. Yeah, absolutely. I saw that, at least I felt that without that identity, I was nothing. But once I had a camera around my neck and a pen and pad in my hand, that I might be accepted. And it was a big shock that I actually could belong somewhere.
Now, when you say you were worse than a pariah, what do you mean?
Oh, kids threw things at us. We were a joke in town. You know, other kids would dare each other to go up around our house. It was pretty bad. And they teased us. I got beat up all the time. But my brother and my sisters, we all fought with each other and for each other. So, you know, on the upside, we really learned to be pretty tough scrappers.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. I mean, the picture that you portray it's sort of this interesting mix of things, because on the one hand, this was a hard life that you've described, but I get the sense that there was no self-pity in your family. I mean, that was a value that was just alien to your parents. I mean, they never went on welfare. Obviously, they could have if they had chosen to. And there was this ethic of stick up for yourself.
Not only stick up for yourself, and not only not feeling sorry for yourself, but Mom always felt and to a large degree gave us the impression that we were better off than the other kids, because we might not have running water, but they weren't reading Shakespeare. So Mom said, you know, try not to look down on them. They don't get art lessons like you kids do. So there was that. And my story is a bizarre contradiction of incredible deprivation in certain areas, but a lot of wealth in other areas. I mean, Mom and Dad did not feed us and did not clothe us very well. But when it came to matters of the mind and soul, they gave us a lot. And ideally, you get both. But if I had to choose, I think I would probably take the mind and soul.
Mm-hmm. Did you buy into their philosophy?
Certainly for the first part of my life, I did. When I was a kid, I thought we had a great life. We could do anything. We could go catch horny toads. We could go out on adventures. I could shoot my dad's gun. We could do whatever we wanted. As I got a little bit older, I think I started seeing through my father's lies. So I rejected everything that they were. Lately, I think I've come to realize that they did give us a lot. So I've sort of come full circle in some ways.
Now, at a fairly young age, you were still a teenager. You hopped on a bus and moved to New York City.
I was 17 years old, and my sister and I hatched a plan to come to New York. She was going to be an artist, and I was going to be a writer. And if I'd had a lick of sense, I would have realized it was a crazy thing to do. But I didn't know any better and came up, and I enrolled in high school up here, and I got an internship and got a job at a newspaper. And I thought I'd just died and gone to heaven. I thought I'd made it. But then the editor there suggested I should probably go to college. And while I was in college, I was listening to the news one day, and there was a report about a van breaking down on the FDR Drive, and the contents had spilled out, and the dog was playing keep away with the cops, and my heart sort of sank, because that's exactly the sort of thing that was happening to us all the time when I was growing up. But I didn't think a whole lot more about it until later on that day I got a call, and it was my mother, and she said, "Jeanette Kunz, we've moved to New York." And I thought, oh, no. I ran away from my past, and it's catching up with me. And I said, "Mom, did your van break down on the FDR Drive?" And she said, "How did you know?" And I said, "It was on the radio." And she took that as a really good sign because they just come to New York and already they're famous. But I wanted nothing to do with them. In fact, I told them, "Please don't tell anybody. You're my parents." Because for the first time in my life, I could actually feel like I was sort of normal and I didn't have to make excuses for my parents and my family. And I didn't have a past as far as most people were concerned. And I didn't want to be saddled with these weird parents again. But things have a funny way of exposing themselves eventually.
Well, and part of this piece of the story is also really interesting because your parents were basically homeless. I mean, they lived in abandoned buildings in they were squatters.
They were actually homeless for a while. They were living on the streets. And then what happened is they took over abandoned buildings on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And there was a squatters movement to take over these buildings. It was, you know, the early 80s, and this was going on. The squatters were fighting with the city. And my parents are incredibly articulate people, so they were always being interviewed on the news and in newspapers. And every time I turned on the TV, it felt like there's my father being interviewed about British common law or quoting John Steinbeck. And it was just mortifying. And I was terrified that this would get out about me. And so I lived in this fear that people would find out who I really was.
And meanwhile, you had become this well-known gossip columnist. You were very plugged into the scene in New York, going to the right parties, living in fancy places by this time, making a lot of money, I presume.
Yes, and hobnobbing with these very well-to-do people who were complaining all the time about those filthy, noisy squatters on the Lower East Side and what they're doing to property values. And I was completely, you know, living between these two worlds, absolutely.
And what's interesting is that your parents, I gather, were not proud of you at this point. I mean, they didn't think that you had become this great success. They sort of thought you'd sold out.
My mother especially, she wanted to know where the values that she raised me with. Here I was a yuppie. It was the worst thing in the world. And my brother had become a cop. It was their children had completely rebelled against them, and they were completely mortified.
Why?
Because they thought that I'd sold out, that my values, that their values, freedom and doing what you chose and not working for the boss man, that I'd abandon that. And that they taught me this life of freedom and doing whatever it was that you pleased. And there I was spending all this money on designer clothes, going to snooty parties and worrying about what people thought of me.
And then for years, at least the way you write about this, you didn't tell people about your background. I mean, even close friends.
Oh, no.
This was all a big secret.
No, in fact, nobody knew. And when people asked me about my past, I would change the topic. In fact, there was only one person who sort of set me down one time, and he said, you know, there's something about your past that doesn't add up. And he said, you know everything about me. This was my best friend. And he said, you know everything about me. I know nothing about you. Whenever I ask you about your past, you change the topic. Why is that? And I said, well, I think if you knew everything about me, you'd drop me as a friend. He said, what do you think? This is high school? I'm going to drop you because of your past? And I refused to tell him. He said, I don't want to be your friend anymore then. It's too insulting to me to think that you think I wouldn't accept you for who I am. So I broke down and told him the whole story. And his first reaction was, that would make a great book. And this is the man I ended up marrying. He turned into my husband and was the person who basically duct taped me to the desk and said, you are writing this story.
Did you ever feel disloyal to your parents, either in the act of telling this or how you distanced yourself from them?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But certainly in how I distance myself from. I sort of kick myself. I feel like a knucklehead now. Like, what was I thinking? On the other hand, I've talked to some people who worked where I did, and they said, I completely understand why you didn't want anybody to know. It was a very snobbish place where your pedigree was very important and what schools you went to were.
And you'd gone to Barnard, so you had the pedigree
well,
to some degree.
Well, people thought I did, but I never went to private schools or boarding schools. People just assumed because I went to Barnard that I must have had a privileged background. But this is a place where, you know, what country clubs your parents belonged to was important. So I thought that if they knew the truth about me, and that there might have been some truth to that. But yeah, I am pretty appalled that I was that cowardly. And I did feel like I was betraying them while I was writing it, too. And, you know, my father, I don't think I could have written it when my father was alive. But I really wondered how my mother would take it. There's some pretty tough scenes about her. It's interesting, people's reactions to my mother. Some people think that she's a monster and should have never had children. Other people think she's a wonderful, unique, free spirit.
So she's been very supportive.
She's been fabulous. She's helped promote it. She was interviewed by Vanity Fair. She was interviewed by a number of people. And in fact, at one point, I wanted to thank her for being so great. And I said, Mom, I want to get you something to thank you. You think about something that you want. It can be big-ish, but you think about what it is that you want and we'll get it. And she said, I don't need to think about it. I know what I want. And she had her eye on an amber and silver bracelet, antique Russian bracelet. And my first reaction was, Mom, I meant something practical like a down payment on a house or a car or something. But I think one of the things I came to realize from writing the book is that what makes me happy isn't what makes my mother happy. And I have to accept, if she wants the darn bracelet, let her have it. It's going to cost me a lot less than a car. So, and she wears the bracelet and she's very happy. She still lives on the Lower East Side. Looks like she's going to be getting, the building's going to become legal. She's going to be able to buy it. She's getting heat for the first time in 15 years. And she's just a very happy woman. One of the people who interviewed her was very concerned that, you know, she's 70 years old, a couple of years older at this point. And she has no heat. And one of the people who interviewed her was very concerned. And he went off and secretly bought her an electric blanket and gave it to her. And he never heard back from her, of course. So he asked me, he said, just make sure your mother got it. And so I asked her, and she said, oh, yes, it was lovely. It was imported wool from Bloomingdale's. I said, well, have you used it? And she said, I have 4 down comforters and 3 fur coats. What do I want with an electric blanket?
Jeanette Walls is a former gossip columnist for New York Magazine and E! She currently appears on MSNBC. She's the author of The Glass Castle. Coming up, the female model for the painting American Gothic sets the record straight.
Nan Wood Graham was insistent that they were supposed to be father and daughter because she couldn't imagine herself married to this 63-year-old dentist.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. If there's one American painting that turns up more often than any other, it's probably American Gothic. I mean, even if you don't know its name, you know those two grim faces peering out at you, with a pitchfork in front and a farmhouse behind. Stephen Beale is the director of the History and Literature program at Harvard University. He wanted to trace the cultural roots of this American classic. The result is the book American Gothic. Beale says parodies of it abound.
Well, the first parody that I'm aware of is a photograph by Gordon Parks from 1942 that has a African-American cleaning woman standing in front of an American flag. That's the first parody I've seen. Really, the parodies took off in the 1960s, so that you see it on commercials for cornflakes, you see it on whiskey bottles, you see it in any number of editorial cartoons about things from farm subsidies to now the war in Iraq or the war on terror. You see it in parodies of presidents and first ladies. There's an artist named Alfred Gescheit in New York who's done really quite brilliant presidential parodies from the Johnsons through the Clintons that many people, I'm sure, have seen on postcards and T-shirts. It's sent up at the beginning of Desperate Housewives. It was sent up on The Simple Life. Sitcoms since the 60s have managed to incorporate American Gothic. There's a Dick Van Dyke episode that's built around American Gothic.
I remember a cartoon in The New Yorker with I Love New York T-shirts on the two of them.
Right. That was right. Yeah, there was a great New Yorker cartoon right after 9/11 that had the couple as kind of representing the heartland with I Heart New York t-shirts, kind of poignantly reaching out to embrace New York in the wake of 9/11. There are horror movies that use American Gothic. Rocky Horror Picture Show, not a horror movie, but there are two American Gothic moments in that. There's an American Gothic moment in The Music Man. It's really all over the place. Once you get into this and you start looking, you find it everywhere. And also, once you tell people you're writing a book about it, they'll just send you stuff endlessly, which is great. I have a wonderful collection of American Gothicana now.
So many of us, of course, have seen what we think is American Gothic, that the original may have been lost to our notions of it. How would you describe it if you were to give the basics of it to a blind person? What would you say about it?
I would say that this is an image of a man and a woman, fairly gaunt, standing in front of a small house with a pronounced, somewhat anomalous Gothic window, that the man is looking straight at us and he's holding a hay fork, and the woman is looking slightly askance. He looks much older than she does, so we aren't sure what the relationship between them might be. There's a barn in the background. There are some beautifully rounded trees in the background. We don't know exactly what they do, but we can imagine that they are either farmers or live in a small town somewhere in the American heartland.
And somehow those two people are the focus of it. Well, not somehow, they are the focus of it. They're right in the front. But there has to be more to it than that, or it wouldn't have grabbed the public's imagination so strongly from the very beginning, don't you think?
Well, Grant Wood said that he started, and this is true, he started not with the people, but with the house. In the summer of 1930, he happened to be in South Central Iowa, and he was driving around one afternoon near the town of Eldon, and he saw this house, and he told his friend who was driving the car to stop and that he wanted to paint it because he was struck by the juxtaposition of this very modest Midwestern house and this Gothic window that seemed somehow out of place. But in any event, he was struck by the window, and that's what really set his mind working on the composition. So he painted it in oils on the spot so that the people were not quite an afterthought, but they weren't the immediate prompt for his painting the image. It's really the window, and it's really the Gothic, in architectural terms, that caught his fancy.
Now, who were the people who were in the painting?
The model for the man was Grant Wood's dentist, Dr. Byron McKeeby, who was 63 at the time that he posed for the painting. And the model for the woman was Grant Wood's sister, Nan Wood Graham, who was in her 30s at the time and was quite insistent when viewers of the painting began to describe them as being a married couple. Nan Wood Graham was insistent that they were supposed to be father and daughter because she couldn't imagine herself married to this 63-year-old dentist.
So what is she looking at?
What is she looking at? Well, she's not looking at us, and she is... Well, neither of them is happy about whatever's going on. So there have been a range of suggestions about why she's looking away, ranging from there's something truly Gothic about what's going on in that house, namely that there's something strange about the relationship between these two figures, maybe some kind of underlying sexual tension. I've heard a very respected art critic suggests that this is clearly an abusive relationship of some kind between the two. As a, to some extent, an old-fashioned empirical historian, I tend not to push my own interpretations quite that far into the realm of speculation, but I do think that it's that sourness, that unhappiness, that makes it really hard to ultimately accept what's become the conventional view of this painting as being an emblem of kind of quintessential Americans at their best. If these people are supposed to represent this nation, that's a really strange choice, I think.
When did the painting first receive public viewing?
Well, the painting was completed, well, in the fall of 1930, and Grant Wood immediately submitted it to the annual competition at the Art Institute of Chicago, where it eked out third prize and $300, and then the Art Institute bought it for its permanent collection for another $300. So it's one of the great all-time art bargains. But some newspaper critics, first in Chicago and then elsewhere around the country, really seized on it, and it was reproduced in papers in New York and Chicago, eventually on the West Coast. So within a matter of weeks and months, it had circulated nationwide and really achieved a kind of instant and permanent fame.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because people's reactions were not entirely positive when they first saw it, but the critics loved it immediately.
The critics loved it, and some viewers absolutely hated it. And the interesting thing about that is that those who loved it and those who hated it seem to have interpreted it in exactly the same way, as being a satire on small town or rural America.
American Gothic isn't just a Midwestern painting, is it, do you think?
No, I don't think it is a Midwestern painting exclusively. Even at the time, a number of commentators said that these people are quintessentially American. They didn't necessarily mean that in a positive way either. They meant that they represented a kind of puritanical streak, a narrowness, a provincialism that wasn't necessarily restricted to the Middle West. But then over time, as the predominant meanings of the painting changed and it came to be seen as a celebratory image of American values and American virtues, there too it remained a kind of symbol of the nation, but a much different symbol, a much more positive symbol.
What is this meant to the painting as a work of art? Do people take it seriously as a work of art these days?
I think some people do and some people don't. I think critical opinion remains divided about it. It's interesting that the New York Times just recently reported that American Gothic has finally made its first appearance in Janssen's History of Art, which is the art history textbook, and has gone through a number of editions. I think it's now in its seventh edition. But Janssen hated Wood, hated regionalists generally, but had a particular hatred for Wood, who he thought was a producer of a kind of dangerous, kitschy, almost nativist, bordering on fascist artwork. And Wood didn't appear, and now finally Grant Wood and American Gothic have shown up in Janssen's History of Art.
There's so many things that go into the popularity of American Gothic, and you wonder whether it's an experience that could have been repeated. It's almost as though he was exactly the right person at the right time to create a work that was going to somehow resonate with viewers over the next decades. This was done in the face of the Depression, although actually just at the very beginning of the Depression, and that must have had an effect.
Right. I mean, I think 1930 is a pivotal moment for this painting to have been created, because on one hand, it does look back, and viewers of it saw it in terms of a certain set of cultural concerns of the 1920s, the spirit of debunking, of cosmopolitanism versus provincialism, of taking a position against narrow religiosity, puritanism, self-righteousness. But it also looks forward to the 1930s, and its meanings change dramatically in the context of the Depression, so that by the middle of the decade, whereas most people in 1930-31 were seeing this as a send-up of rural or small-town life and as poking fun, whether gently or not, at these denizens of the Midwest, by the mid-30s, it's widely come to be seen as a kind of homage to American steadfastness and virtue and stability and the kinds of virtues and national characteristics that would allow Americans to weather the hard times of the 1930s. And that even gets galvanized further in the context of World War II, where, for example, Fortune magazine proposes American Gothic as a war poster to boost morale on the home front. This is only 10 or 11 years after its original appearance, and the meaning has been completely transformed in the context of the Depression and World War.
I mean, American Gothic has gotten to the point now where it almost doesn't belong to Grant Wood anymore.
I think it's long ceased to belong to Grant Wood. I think it stopped belonging to Grant Wood within a matter of months after he painted it. I think one of his reactions was to try to reclaim it and to try to say, this is what I meant to do, because it was already kind of taking off into popular culture and into on its way to iconic status, and his intentions ceased to matter entirely in that process.
Stephen Beal is the director of the History and Literature Program at Harvard University and the author of American Gothic. Song Ugly Man from the American country band Freakwater. Freakwater can sound like they come right off the front porch of Appalachia, and tradition is a starting point for the Freakwater sound. To the best of our knowledge, producer Veronica Rickert spoke with lead singers of Freakwater about their new album, Thinking of You.
Catherine Irwin and Janet Beveridge Bean are the lead singers of Freakwater. The band has a devoted following on the alt-country scene. They've been called one of the most traditionally grounded bands in that genre, with their plaintive harmonies and stark acoustic arrangements. Their back porch, almost Appalachian sound, has earned them numerous comparisons to the legendary Carter family, who advised, keep it plaintive, rough, and real.
That's one of my favorite things in, like, the music of the Carter family or people like that, where they have, like, the really such a flat delivery of the lyrics, which are oftentimes so incredibly grim and morbid, but over the top of fairly perky musical accompaniment.
Yeah, melodic line and speed and everything else, yeah.
Like the Carters, Freakwater has no trouble being grim. In fact, they're well known for the midnight black of their subject matter. You could call it musical American Gothic, song after song about death, abuse, and destitution. Writing about despair comes easy to the women of Freakwater.
Most of the time when you're singing about something that's good or something that's nice that happens to you, it doesn't come across very well. You know, it's like a photograph. When you see a really beautiful setting and you're on your vacation and you take a photograph of it because it's so great, it never lives up to what it is in the photograph. And I think sometimes trying to convey a happy sentiment is the same way.
Freakwater takes some ribbing for their numerous dead children songs, like Kathy Ann, a song from their new album, Thinking of You. Kathy Ann is the story of Woody Guthrie's daughter who died from burns she got in a house fire.
Kathy Ann, hold out your little hand. If your daddy didn't love you, there's just no good in
Irwin, who wrote the song Kathy Ann, has second thoughts about the song now and how it might sound to the Guthrie family, but still considers it a beautiful song based on a moving story.
The sky was always blue. Well, your daddy drew.
Freakwater dives deeper into Americana with the song So Strange. It's a novelty song that owes a lot to the bass clarinet and Elvis movie soundtracks.
Once we started recording it with the drummer and everybody playing on it, then it seemed like it was kind of taking on a certain, like, Anne Margaret dancing around the pool kind of a
twisting, you know,
flavor.
It's so strange what you told me. Please hold chains to hold me and drag me down to the church.
Lots of the Freakwater material comes from personal experience. Irwin and Bean have been singing together since they were in Louisville, Kentucky. They used to sit around in mud masks singing Tammy Wynette songs. They're comfortable together, and it shows. They can talk and sing about anything. So a lot of their songs are about the kind of things lifelong girlfriends talk to each other about. Divorce, death, or addiction. Their song Hi-Ho Silver explores their ambivalence toward 12-step programs.
Hi-Ho Silver, hi-ho.
Programs are also fairly irritating to me. The whole, like, the higher power, which seems to be at the heart of almost all of the 12-step programs. I mean, I realize that they do help people, but at the same time, I can't stand that part of it. Yeah, we'd like to kick that crutch out from underneath the arm of the alcoholic, basically. And that's what we're trying to do.
And I think that's a positive thing.
I think it is.
Because then you're then in the here and now, you know? It's not like all gonna happen later on.
So far, Freakwater has avoided the big time over the years, passing up an offer from Steve Earle's Warner Associated label to stay with the smaller label, Thrill Jockey. But for Irwin and Bean, that's just fine. Their real problem is running out of material when life's downs are turning into ups.
I was only really able to come up with one song because I've actually been, everything has been really great for me and I've been pretty happy the last few years, and so I just couldn't come up with a single song to write. Luckily, Catherine had enough things that she was dealing with that she could fill up the record.
I took up the slack there.
Catherine Irwin and Janet Beveridge Bean are the lead singers of the band Freakwater. They spoke with TT Book producer Veronica Rickert. Freakwater's new album is called Thinking of You. Coming up, we'll taste an American icon, apple pie. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. If there's one symbol for America that just won't go away, it's apple pie. Politicians evoke the dessert to increase their appeal. Artists study its significance in the American social landscape. But just why is apple pie such a loaded metaphor for America? Is the real thing as appealing as the idea? John T. Edge is a food writer who's written for Gourmet magazine. He's also the author of the book, Apple Pie, An American Story. He told Steve Paulson that the roots of apple pie in America go back a long ways.
I think that it symbolizes kind of home and hearth for everyone. It symbolizes the bounty of America. There was a time not too long past when an apple tree wasn't that far from your back door, and an apple pie was not that hard to bake. We seem to look upon it now as with kind of misty-eyed reflection, but I would argue that an apple pie still isn't so darn hard to bake, and it still symbolizes this kind of bounty of America, this kind of wealth of America, both kind of in terms of fond recollection and also, you know, on the palate. It's something wonderful made frugal.
Is the apple pie an American invention?
It's an American, how would I say this? It's a food that we Americans remade. It is arguably a food that the British refined and that we remade in our own image. A food that we, by way of cooking, by way of telling stories, by way of kissing babies and eating hot dogs and politicians proclaiming their love of motherhood and apple pie, a dish that we came to claim as our own, but not a dish that we invented. There's no such thing as the first apple pie. It's like finding the first fried chicken leg or the first hamburger. It's a quest that's not worth seeking. I think what is worth seeking is finding, you know, the kind of local traditions, the local pies, the pies that reflect terroir, to use that fancy pants French term, the pies that reflect who we are and what places we live. Those are the pies that matter. It's going out to the Southwest and finding pies goosed with hot peppers. It's going.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you went all around the country sampling all kinds of different pies, and there are some pretty funky things that get into some of these pies. So, for instance, in New Mexico, pies baked with, I mean, apple pies baked with green chilies, right?
Yeah. Senior pie is the way this gentleman I met out in Albuquerque, a guy named Scott Robinson, it's how he styled himself, senior pie. And the Hispanic ingredient, the way that he kind of de-anglicized the pie, was the addition of green chili peppers. Very much indigenous to that place, very much a part of, you know, if you think about the New Mexican version of Mexican food, you think about green chilies from Hatch and environs. But in fact, when you add it to pie, you get this wonderful kind of slow burn heat that will bead the top of your lip, but will not send you gasping for water or a glass of milk.
So does this still taste like an apple pie, but just with a little bit of extra oomph to it?
It does. In some ways, the kind of green taste of the chilies kind of points up the apples. It cuts through some of the sweetness and brings the taste of the apple more into focus for me. I really like it.
Now, you went all over the place and tried all kinds of different pies. For instance, wasn't there a cinnamon red hot apple pie?
Indeed, in Iowa. This is something that, you know, if you think about folk foods, those foods that have been cooked for a long while that we love because our grandmama cooked it or, you know, our great-grandmother cooked it, this is a more recent invention. And if you think about the traditional play of cinnamons and apples and sugar, this is a way to kind of jury-rig that. It's the addition of cinnamon red hots to the dough, to the pie mix. You get the cinnamon you want. You also get, in the same way as the green chili apple pie, you get this pleasing bite, this snap of heat. And when the red hots cook, the steam vents in the pie end up being tinged this lovely kind of coral pink color. But when then you try to kind of map the origins of this pie, you realize, you know, this is something that is just, you know, kind of casual. It's not something that someone set out to do. You know, it's a day in the kitchen. You're out of cinnamon. You reach for the red hots that your child might have brought home from the corner store. You throw that in knowing that it's got that pleasing bite of cinnamon to it. And then the phenomenon starts to spread. Another person picks up on it, another person, and it becomes a goof, something playful. And what's wrong with a playful apple pie?
Well, and that shows that food has really taken on a life of its own. I mean, when it starts being tinkered with and slightly altered in every corner of the country.
Yeah, it does. It shows that apple pie is something that we accept kind of from the Atlantic to the Pacific as our own. And by toying with it, by tinkering with it, we lay claim to its localness as opposed to saying, well, this is a dish that is, you know, that is monochromatic, that is this monoculture of apple pie from coast to coast. And in fact, people want to reinvent it. They want to lay claim to it. They want to tinker with it, to make it their own, to make some stab at originality. Why not tinker with apple pie a little bit?
So what does it take to make a really great apple pie?
The bones of a great pie is a great crust. In my experience, working with cold ingredients and working with good ingredients, good butter or good lard, you know, that's the bones, that's the basics, that's the backbone of a great pie is the crust.
So what kind of apples make the best apple pies?
Ah, now that's a hard one. I come back to this argument. Whatever apple you can get that's local, that's the apple to use. I don't like Red Delicious. I mean, that's a place to start. I think those are, put it this way, the pies that you see in the grocery store that look so beautiful, that came shipped in from somewhere else, that are just glowing, polished red, waxed really well, those are not the apples to use. The gnarly, ugly ones that have got character, those are the apples to use.
Well, tell me a few varietals that you especially like.
Well, I've got a lovely list of them. Let me read them off to you. Toward that same point of kind of the the grocery store apples I don't like. Mm-hmm. There's a great quote from Jack Butler, who's a novelist, who said that grocery store apples have all the fiber of a politician's moral courage and all the flavor of a CEO's reading habits. Those are the apples you don't want to use.
Well, and I think a lot of people would agree with you on the Red Delicious. I mean, whether you put them in apple pies or whatever. I mean, that's not exactly an advertisement for fine eating.
No, it's not. But I think Americans are waking up to these other varieties. Braeburns, I love. Pink Ladies, which are kind of tangy. Cameos, which are juicy. All these kind of very localized varieties, these heirloom varieties of apples. And they really are, when you look at them in the store, they've not been bred for beauty, but for taste. They're not likely to be as beautiful and shiny as the Red Delicious. But, you know, beneath that kind of gnarly skin lies a beautiful, rich apple. There's such a range in apples, from something that can be incredibly tart. Like when I was a child, I remember biting into crab apples off trees. You know, they'll take your head off. They're so tart. But there's a continuum that goes from that tartness that puckers, it's like biting into a lemon, rind and all, to something that is almost insipidly sweet, like the Red Delicious. Between those two poles lies the apple you want, the Braeburn, the Cameo, the Pink Lady. And you'll see now as you travel, and I think one of the great ways to figure out an apple pie is to get on the road and stop at fruit stands when the apples are coming in and pick an apple. Talk to the fruit stand guy. They'll help you figure out what's great to bake with. Take that apple home. Figure it out. Figure out, does it need a little more sugar? Does it need a little more cinnamon? What makes it great?
Now, we've been talking about this symbolic value of apple pie, and some people have played with that idea. I mean, for instance, you met a performance artist in Brooklyn, I believe, who did something with apple pies.
Yeah, this woman, she's delightful. Her name's Anissa Mack. And in the summer of, I think it was 2002, she started baking pies in this storybook cottage that she set up near the Brooklyn Public Library. I mean, it was this perfect scene. I saw a video of this. I never actually saw this. I ended up spending a lot of time with Anissa and talking through this phenomenon. But she set up what is everybody's idealized vision of a cabin, a little rural cabin. You know, she put a hand-hewn spice rack on the wall. She put an oven in the back, and she made pie four times a day. She'd make a pie. She'd put it on the windowsill to cool. This all, remember, in the shadow of the Brooklyn Public Library, in a traffic median with traffic just thrumming by, buses, cars going everywhere, Anissa would bake a pie four times a day, put it on the windowsill, and then wait for someone to steal it.
And did they?
Of course they did.
The whole pie? They didn't just take a slice of it?
No, there were people. There were swipes of entire pies. There were some people that stopped to share. There were tussles over pie. I don't think there were blows, but I think there were, you know, raised knives or forks at one another. But she was exploring this idea, that kind of mythical idea. Do you remember the Saturday Evening Post cover from the 1930s of a tramp, a hobo, stealing a pie off a windowsill? You know, that pie, that swipe of a pie by a tramp during the Depression, during hard times, you know, someone had access to an apple tree. You know, they baked a pie, they put it on the windowsill to cool, and the tramp comes by and swipes it. You know, it is a victimless crime in many ways. The tramp sees this farmer woman who has access to apples, who's baked a pie. He swipes it away. She, Anissa Mack, wonders, by way of this exhibit, by way of her interactive art, you know, how does that play in the year 2002? How does it play in the 21st century? Will they still swipe pies? Would someone trust a baker to make a pie that wasn't laced with, you know, all manner of, you know, harmful chemicals? You know, is this the kind of naivete of that swipe? Does it still play? And how does the pie function as a symbol in 21st century America? She didn't offer answers to that. I think by way of staging that, she asked some questions.
Now, I'm going to put you on the spot here. If you had to pick out the single best apple pie that you have tasted, or the apple pie experience that you had, what would it be?
It's easy. I don't like to play favorites, and I've got 20 different ways to dodge this question that I've developed over time, but I'm not going to do it. The Marlboro pie is my favorite. And this is a pie that really is place-specific. New England is where you find it. If you read the writings of Harriet Beecher Stowe, the great abolitionist, she was obsessed with Marlboro pie. She wrote beautifully of the pies. She called them Marlboro pudding pies. And she thought that they attested to the boundless fertility of the feminine mind when let loose in a given direction.
So what is this pie? What's in it?
This pie is grated apples, not as you would normally think of, a sliced apple. You grate an apple. You mix in a bit of sherry, a bit of lemon, 3 eggs, and you make a custard, in essence, that you pour into a pie shell. You end up with this, the sherry and the lemon and the sugar in the pie. They play off each other, and you get this really heady mix that is a little bit musky, a little bit sweet, really custardy, and because you've grated the apples, there's some texture to it, too. It's amazingly good, and for those people who are kind of intimidated by the idea of, you know, will I end up with too loose a filling in my pie when I cut in? I don't like it when it starts to run and fall apart. This is the solution. It's amazingly good, and has, even though I'm a good old Southern boy from down deep south, it's become our family apple pie, the one that we serve on Thanksgiving, the one that we serve when we make a pie. It's become Marlboro pie.
John T. Edge. He's the author of the book Apple Pie, An American Story. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, and Doug Gordon. Our intern is Megan Manning. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. Kirill Owen, our technical director. You can buy a copy of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for American Classic, number 430B. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.